You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Films, the official expanded universe podcast of StarWarsReport.com.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
Welcome to episode number 34 of Star Wars Beyond the Films, your Star Wars discussion podcast. We broadcast on Middle Earth Network Radio as well as on the Star Wars Report website, StarWarsReport.com. Our episodes are also available on our own Facebook page at facebook.com/SWBeyondFilms. But enough about how you got here, let's get the show started. I am one of your hosts, Nathan P. Butler. With me, as always, my stalwart companion and the defender of the EU, Mr. Mark Herleman. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Nathan. Audience. Great fans of the Star Wars Expanded Universe and droids everywhere. That's right, Whistler. We like droids. And speaking of droids, I saw some really cool pictures from Celebration 6. Some R2 unit fleets out there. I saw a really cool Lego one that was the size of all the rest. But speaking of Celebration 6, it has kicked off at the moment of this recording. Our contest has came to an end. Be sure to hit our Facebook page to find out who the lucky winner was. Their copy of Fatal Alliance will be sent out to them by the end of Celebration 6. And you can find all that out on our Facebook page.
That's right. And speaking of Celebration 6, just to give you guys a sense of where we're going the next few weeks, because most of the time we don't really tell you that until we figure it out and post it on the Facebook page. Looks like right now, the next few weeks, we are going to start next week by taking a look at announcements coming out of Celebration 6, very much like we did with San Diego Comic-Con, hopefully with better news this time. And we will be then going into the X-Wing novel series. We're going to take a look at Michael Stackpole's contributions as a whole, then Aaron Alston's contributions as a whole, minus Mercy Kill, and then we will cap it off with our in-depth look at X-Wing Mercy Kill, the newest X-Wing book after, 13 years or whatever it was. So we've got quite a bit still coming up here as the school year starts for all of you know, public school and college people and teachers out there who are crying about the summer being gone, like me.
Yeah, we'll post it on the Facebook page, Yeah, it wasn't that funny, Whistler, I know. Now, here at Star Wars Beyond the Films, we ask the tough questions. Questions that have bothered you for a long time, or simple ones that have perplexed you off and on. You ponder about Star Wars, and so do we. This episode, we look at the last and yet newest story of the Lost Tribe of the Sith, the collected stories, Pandemonium. Consider this year's spoiler warning, Beyonders, because here we go.
It's Pandemonium! Kind of sounds like some kind of Star Wars wrestling event, doesn't it?
Two, you know? Sith enter, one Sith leaves!
Look at the Jubilar free-for-all or whatever it is, where Boba Fett first sees Han Solo. It's a free-for-all!
Nice.
Snap into a Slim Jim! Anyway.
Alisar, Thunderdome, two Sith enter, one Sith leave.
This is true. Well, what we're looking at here, folks, if you want to put this in the context of the other stories that we've been looking at, we've already hit the first eight. And those eight were all released as ebooks. So those were available free at first. Now you can buy them as part of the collected stories, but they were available for free as ebooks. Now what we've done is we've moved past the free content, past the original ebook content, and we're into the one story that is significantly longer than all the others. I think they originally said it was going to be about 90 pages, winds up being over 100. And this is a story, Pandemonium, that not only wraps up the series, in a sense, while setting up things for Spiral, but it's also the only one that made its debut in print and is only available from a legitimate purchasing source as opposed to it being something that's available for free. So even if you wanted this in ebook form, you couldn't get it individually. You'd have to get the Collected Stories ebook that you pay for, and it'd be included in there. That's what made this book a little controversial, but I think the content quality has made it so that most people have not griped too much about this particular book series being collected in this form, because it does make a very good ending story.
See, and I'm one of those that have griped. I see it as the circle. You know, I always talk about circles. Life's about circles. At one point, I was on the other end of the circle. I would complain about the fact that I'd have to pay $12 or more or less, depending on where I'm finding it online, to get this for that one story. But now I kind of see it as a good reason to do this kind of venture. You know, from the forum standpoint, we've been asking for more tales of books for a long time. And there are a lot of exclusives that Insider and StarWars.com have put out online and stuff like that that would be cool to see collected in this format. And I think that this could very easily be a test run for more of those online books finding their way to print and seeing who would be interested in paying for something that has already been out there or available in a degree, you know, left or right here, would you still get it? And I'm actually – I think that this is a good idea, and if they down the road decide to make Pandemonium available on Kindle or something like that, granted, there will be ways because that's what we fans do, but I think that that too would be a winning strategy. I mean, granted, right now, yeah, you're banking on the only way to get this is to buy the paperback. But honestly, I think down the road, maybe a year, maybe 2 years, maybe even 3 years, I could see him putting Pandemonium for sale in a Kinect, Kindle form. Kinect. I just got an Xbox 360, Kinect obviously. Form. It's on my mind.
Wave your hands and read.
Yes. But I think that that's a good way to go. I mean, I want to have my library in a digital format down the road. And I think about that a lot because my collection is paperbacks. If I could go back and do it again, I think I would probably get one of those sci-fi hardcover book club things and get the hardcovers. I've talked with a few people on our forums, on our Facebook page about it and all that. And I really think that's the best way to go when it comes to test of time with your collection. But ebook is definitely another direction to go to do the same thing. Now, if I have my paperback collection, I can read that, have the physical copy, but then turn around and use my ebook copy whenever. I don't have to worry about the bindings wearing out, any of that stuff. So I would like to see Pandemonium down the road being available in that format. I think it'd work out good.
Well, three comments jumping off of what you just said there, because there's a lot of information there, to be honest with you. It may not have felt like it, but there's three things that really jumped to mind. One is, let's keep in mind here, because I know there are some who are going to say, based on that suggestion, well, if they make Pandemonium available for free or even available for purchase separately, then that makes it so it was sort of a bait and switch to have us buy this book in the first place. They're just doing the Ultimate Sith Edition thing with the Force Unleashed and the Hoth mission all over again. Bear in mind, no one, as far as I know, has said the only place you'll ever be able to get Pandemonium is from this book. And even the book itself says, includes the explosive never-before-published finale Pandemonium on the front, and on the back it says, along with the explosive never-before-published finale Pandemonium, more than 100 pages of new material. Nothing says it's the only place you'll ever be able to get it.
Yeah,
so in
exactly.
That sense, you know, I don't feel like that's bait and switch. It would make sense for them to release it later, perhaps to soak a little bit more money out of it if people said, nope, I'm not going to buy it because I already have the other ones. At least they'll be able to get at least a minor profit out of it. Also, you mentioned the idea of us wanting more Tales of books and this possibly being a trial run. There is another kind of quasi-trial run of that out there at the moment. I don't have my copy of it yet. Arnie Carvalho was nice enough to find a copy of it for me at San Diego Comic-Con, and he's going to be mailing it to me after Celebration 6. But Del Rey's little like free giveaway booklet thing, like a promo booklet that they had at San Diego Comic-Con, and I'm assuming they have it at Celebration 6 as well, is essentially a booklet with little excerpts from a bunch of their modern Star Wars novels, plus short stories out of the pages of recent Star Wars Insider. So there are some places where it seems like they're toying with this again, and they know we've been asking for it for a long time. It's just a question of, is there enough content to justify it? Would enough people buy it? I think you're running into a little bit more of a iffy ground when it comes to the Insider short stories, because in the case of Insider, most people have it in physical form in a magazine, as opposed to it being something only digital. You mentioned the whole idea of only digital as a collection. I actually thought about duplicating my collection, having digital as well, so it's easier to search for when I'm doing stuff on the timeline and whatnot, although it'd be freaking crazy expensive to do that. My concern with that is that not everything is available in digital format, and I don't think it's something we need to worry about too much in the foreseeable future, but Arnie and some of the other guys who do a lot of Star Wars collecting and have been collecting digital comics in some cases for years before the apps became a big deal have mentioned the idea of, well, what if you buy a bunch of digital content, let's say through Kindle or let's say through the Nook, and then one or the other or both of those companies, Amazon or Barnes & Noble, go out of business and nobody picks it up from there? Or what if we get to a point where digital format changes so much that you wouldn't be able to use those types of digital books on a modern digital reader? Basically, what you would wind up with is the potential that your digital content would be gone. I've found that myself. There's those old Star Wars books like A Forest Apart and Fool's Bargain, all those old ebooks. I went through and had to essentially repurchase on the Nook because at that point, on my desktop computer, there have been so many different upgrades and changes and alterations to the different ebook reader programs that were used when I purchased those in the first place, that half of them couldn't open, And the other half, I didn't have the programs for. I think there was one of them that I was able to still open and read if I had wanted to from the ones released back, you know, around the time of New Jedi Order and such. So you, with digital, you do run the risk of, unless, of course, I guess they're, you know, they're bootleg digital and they're just JPEG files or something, you do run the risk of, what if that reader at some point, that device becomes obsolete or that format becomes obsolete? So for me, I think the space is worth it to have a physical copy of something. And that's why if something is digital only, I still want to get a physical version of it if they ever decide to collect it, like with Lost Tribe of the Sith. I think for a collector, I think the jury on digital is still out. I'm not quite yet willing to put all my eggs in that basket.
Yeah. I'm in the same boat, you know, and shame on the Nook, you know. It's one of those things that I think that if they did go in a direction where they changed to a new reader format or something like that, and the old format became obsolete, I really think that that's going to be a situation where shame on the company for allowing that to happen. I have an issue when it comes to getting like the Xbox 360. I just got one. And part of my issue there was I wanted to be able to play my old games. It really irks me that you have these companies that put out these new systems and then boom, oh, the old games are just now obsolete. They do have some of them, the older ones, they do have that reverse engineering, whatever it's called. I can't
remember. Backward compatibility.
Yes, that. Thank you. And I think it's stupid of these companies not to have that on all their systems. I mean, why wouldn't you want people to be able to enjoy your older systems and be able to sell those as well? I just think that any company that goes forward and forsakes what came before, I don't know. Maybe it's a continuity guy in me here.
let me give you at least a little bit of the business background of that, because I have felt the same way, especially when, you know, we got to a point where these new video game systems, for instance, are costing hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of dollars. I mean, the first PlayStation 3 that I bought, I want to say, was probably $500 at the time, or the only PlayStation 3 that I've bought. But in a lot of cases, you do have backward compatibility with this generation. Wii can go backward compatible and play old GameCube games. In fact, that's about all I play on my Wii anymore is old GameCube games. The PlayStation 3, at least when it was initially launched, the first few versions of it, up until the point they made that slim version, could play PS2 games or PS1 games. All of them now can still play PS1 games. In that case, it was a question of making it more affordable to the consumer by taking out certain chips. Like, it started out with a hardware-based ability to play PlayStation 2 games, I think it was. Then it became a software-based emulation where it wasn't exactly going to work with all games, but some. And then they just took it out essentially completely, and now they're doing some things where they're retooling and re-releasing them as digital titles. And from what I understand, I haven't done a whole lot of Xbox backward compatibility stuff, but that system is pretty heavily backward compatible with Xbox. The 3DS can play DS games. The DS could play Game Boy Advance games. The Vita can play many, not all, but quite a few of the digital PlayStation Network Store PS1 and PSP games. So it's not, I don't think it's that they're avoiding it per se. I think it's just a matter in many cases of the cost aspect. And if in Sony's case, if you still have the previous system selling well, then shoot, why would you make it so that people didn't have to buy that? I think there's just that, it's that clash between logic and financial stability and such for some of these companies, especially when a lot of them, when they first start selling video game systems that are already expensive, a lot of them start selling them at a loss just to get people into them and buying the software that helps make up for those losses, because these things are stinking expensive at this point. Though e-readers are coming down in price, so I'm hoping that means that maybe compatibility between e-readers will be something we don't have to worry about as much as, say, with video game systems. I'm crossing my fingers.
You'd think, though, that like Del Rey would put out a version of your book that's like, say, $5 or $2 more, where you get a code that unlocks a digital version of the book so you can get both. Make it like the Blu-ray that has the DVD.
The digital copy. They do that with comics sometimes too. DC Comics does that.
Marvel as well, and I think that that's a great idea. And originally they were sealing those comics because they were worried about people getting them. And now they've got a little sticker on the inside that peels off, so you can actually open the comic and read it still. Because a lot of people were like, well, it's sealed. How do I know if I like the comic? And the comic dealer's like, well, they got it sealed because there's this digital copy in there. And then the people go out and they kind of go, but I don't know if I even want to buy the comic because it could really suck, man. Spider-Man's cool.
Excuse me. This is a store, not a library. Do you have your library card with you, young man?
Yeah. I put that Star Trek phaser out there to catch you. Now, getting actually back into our book, though, You know, last episode we talked about the maps and how we have a map at the beginning of Pandemonium for Alencar. I'm probably going to say it a few different ways here. I love it. I talked about how I like that they put it in there and you found out about it after the fact. But one thing that I wish that we had is a world map. You know, something that even if they had grayed out areas like at the polar regions where we didn't know about. But if we had like an actual – I like to know exactly where – LNCR lines up with Keshta. I would really like to see that. I love the way that the story as it plays out and how the Sith, when they get here, the way that they come at the island. You know, there's these six claws that hang down where they got all these bases and fortresses at. And basically the currents are what sets them. I mean, basically the currents set up the whole premise of how the Sith come at this continent. And the way that those currents work, and they don't really quite understand it, the Kashyyri of Alencar, they have, you know, they've mastered sailing, they've got big trees, unlike the other Sith. I like the way that played out. Again, I would like to see a world map. That would have been cool to see how it played together, but I like the maps. It's something I really hope Del Rey continues. Later in the book, I believe it was chapter 17 even, they talk about vast areas of Kesh, like the unknown northern hemisphere, absent from Corsin's ancient map, might now become accessible. This is talking about now that they have access to a fleet. Could there be more natives, more mysteries there? The prospect excited Adele. And I thought, ooh, that's a little Spiral reference there to what we see at the end of issue one of Spiral. I thought that was a cool little John Jackson Miller tie-in there. And, you know, I was talking to my roommate about the plot here with the Sith as it gets going. And he was like, oh, that sounds a lot like... what did he say it was? Mass Effect. He said, that sounds like a plot in Mass Effect. And I'm like, huh, well, it is by the same guy that wrote the comic.
This is true. Speaking of sort of things that that were new frontiers, if you want to call it that, I caught that Spiral thing looking back on it. That's kind of cool. I like the idea of them connecting them. I hope that Spiral becomes something other than just a quick little, like, miniature story that doesn't really add a whole lot to the overall grand scheme of things. I worry any time that we end one story and add a little end cap type thing onto it in a different medium that is supposed to go on, but it turns out that it's not going on, that we're going to get the same kind of feeling like a lot of people get with Babylon 5 with that short-lived series Crusade. Like, Babylon 5 was this complete, whole, well-rounded story, and then now here's this other story tacked onto it that in theory should have kept going, but now it just feels like, oh, now it feels unfinished. Before, it felt great. Now it feels unfinished. But speaking of new territory, we are in a new time period. We are 25 years later, so we've had time for the Hilt's restoration, Varner Hilt's time as Grand Lord, to give the Sith a chance to build back up from that time of rot that we saw previously in the aftermath, seeing in the previous two stories. We also, I gotta say, the story concept that kicks this off at the beginning, with the first characters that we meet, Cora Thane, and so forth. I find it interesting, and it feels like it's new territory for Star Wars, for us to begin the saga with essentially a woman wanting to cheat on her husband.
I was shocked. I was like, are you kidding me? I mean, I'm laughing, and my wife's like, what? And I'm like, this is a first. I'm like, is this really happening even?
She's kind of a temptress, and she's tempted. I mean, she's making her way, and she's on this, it sounds like, it feels like she's on a secret mission there at the beginning. Ooh, what is she doing? Only to realize that she's sneaking away from her husband, who she finds very, very boring, to go up and meet with the man that she's been conversing with all this time in this sort of you got mail long distance relationship thing. What's funny is, and on a side note, is when I was first thinking about this, right before we were getting ready to record, Jody and I had just been joking around about just stupid stuff that we'd seen on TV and just goofy stuff. And I started thinking about this, and I kind of was muttering to myself about it while I was sort of thinking out loud, getting the thoughts together. And one of the things that came out was I made that little, I guess they call it like the 1970s bad exploitation or porn music type thing that has become a joke with the bow chicka meow meow kind of thing, right? Only to realize that if you take that and make it less twangy and just use a regular instrument, it's boom, 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 boom. That's the freaking Cialis commercial. They use the Cialis, they use 1970s bad porn music turned into something kinder but the same rhythm and same notes to be the Cialis erectile dysfunction commercial. Thank you very much. The connection is made.
Yeah,
it all works now.
I did find it shocking, and I like the fact that it was her going out of her way to set things in motion. I don't know why, but naturally when I assume someone's going to be an adulteress or an adulterator or whatever, however you say it, when you're going to cheat on your spouse, your significant other, I don't know, I just naturally assume it's going to be a guy. I don't know why, maybe because guys can tend to be pigs. But the fact that Joran didn't have a clue, and when everything goes down, she is freaking out. I'm not even supposed to be here! I'm like, oh, it's Clerks 2 moment right here. I'm not even supposed to work today! I'm just like, wait, what is she doing? And she's like turning and burning, and the guy's like, but you need to touch the Force, because she's one of the few Kesh that can touch the Force. You need to send a thought message out. And she's like, I'm not supposed to be, I gotta go! She's like turning and burning, man. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, she winds up essentially being, I mean, she fits the stereotypical male adulterer role in a story where, well, they're originally going to wind up cheating. In any disaster movie, they're really going to originally wind up cheating, say like Rayford Steele maybe in the beginning of the Left Behind novels, for instance. But then a catastrophe happens, and then he winds up, or she winds up in this case, you know, worrying about the family, and in the process of going to find the family, winds up going back to the family and realizing that that's what's really of value. I mean, that's kind of the stereotypical story arc, but this turns it on its head just enough by having it be a woman that you're not entirely sure at the end, is she going to go in Adari's form and wind up working aside Adele so she can keep a close eye on the Sith, or is she going to go back to her family? I was actually kind of surprised she would decide to go back, but it makes me wonder.
I was expecting a whole Sith aspect of it. It's like, oh, she's totally self-centered. I was expecting Adele to, you know, and at one point he was kind of grooming her that way. You know, you're totally thinking like a Sith. You're practicing Sith philosophies. I was actually envisioning her at one point just totally being all about herself and just joining up with the Sith. And by the end of the book, I kind of felt like she was more Adari, the way Adari was rebelling. She kind of took on that persona of like, okay, I'm going to be the new leader of the rebellion kind of thing. I mean, they didn't flat out say it, but that was the vibe I definitely got.
What I wonder is, can we say now, thanks to this book, that Star Wars, at least in recent memory, now again, thanks again to John Jackson Miller, like with Kara Holt, that we're getting strong female characters in abundance who are not the stereotype, who show not only that they can be strong leaders, they can be strong characters like Adari was, or like Cora is here as the story goes along, or Sela. As Sela or any of them, but also women who have the same flaws as men. So it's not that men have these flaws, women have these other flaws, that it's human beings are flawed, and whether we make it a male or female character, we want to get that across. That it's not about gender, it's about character. So a good female characterized is just as good as a good male characterized, and there's more balance to the gender here. As much as we talk about how Star Wars feels unbalanced when it comes to women in a lot of ways, I think John Jackson Miller, whether he means to or not, has done a great job with both Knight Errant and this, the Lost Tribe of the Sith stuff, to give us something that's a little bit different. It's a breath of fresh air in that sense, but it's not beating you over the head with it. It's not, look, here's a strong woman, here's a strong woman, whack, whack, whack. I mean, here's a character that she feels like she's a, I don't want to say a weak character, but she's definitely a deeply flawed character when we first meet her, because the first thing we know about her, aside from her job, is that she's going out there to essentially cheat on her husband, but he develops her from there. I mean, he doesn't beat you over the head with, hey, it's a strong woman, but at the same time, we have some very good female characters here that stand out amongst the relatively scant handful of really strong female leads that we've seen in Star Wars beyond the films themselves.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, Kara Holt's character, what's going on in Escape especially, is some deep stuff. But another thing I liked was how Adari's character was used later to kind of give you a perspective on Yaru Korsan and how, you know, when there was that whole back and forth between Sela and Adari and how Yoru just kind of sat back and watched it happen. And as she was explaining it to the listener of whatever, you know, her memoirs, it was, you know, it's not a Sith thing. It was just a male thing. And I liked how she was able to see it for what it was. You know, she saw him for what it was. You know, she actually saw the gender versus the, well, it's a human trait. No, it's just a male trait. Like, she recognized that. Like, no, you're just being a chauvinistic pig.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, he's good at putting things in perspective like that. One thing also that jumps out at me from a perspective angle here, the historical perspective in this case, is something that I think I mentioned back, I guess it was our first episode about this, and I think you referenced it again in our second, about the idea of how the technology of the Sith, kind of it starts up high because they come to the world with the technology that they had from the Sith Empire. It dips as they sort of go into a darker age and their technology starts to wear out and such, and they have to rebuild and essentially come up with new technologies. I think this is the one that put me in the perspective of really feeling as though I like this era, and I feel like I could picture it very, very well as a really different era in terms of technology. It's not a type of era where it all just kind of looks the same. It's not like what they've been doing with, for some reason, Knight Errant Escape, where somehow there's a freaking Republic gunship and clone trooper-looking helmets running around.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
It really does. I mean, you've got the ships. He describes them well. The airships that the Sith use. The idea of using the Uvox as being essentially steering mechanisms as they're carried on air currents, what we think of essentially as a hot air balloon type of thing. To see that type of technology, it sort of fleshed out this era for me in this one much more than in any of the other ones. Of course, he also had more time to flesh it out in this one compared to any of the other ones. But things like how they were shooting the spears and stuff to go up there and try to pop the balloons and whatnot, how they were able to prepare with limited technology, how they used the lighthouses and such as a way of sending messages around. I definitely got a feel of, I mean, almost like a Game of Thrones type or a Lord of the Rings feel as far as the technology went.
Yeah, it wasn't, I was totally Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, like it wasn't tacked on. It wasn't just, well, here's Star Wars and let's just degrade the technology. The technology felt like it was a natural, important part of the era and this particular culture. You know, the struggle came down to essentially one of technology versus technology to a degree, and the technology, in a sense, the lighthouse is being used against the Kashyyyri, against the people of Alanciar, because, well, that's what Corsan, or the Corsanite leader, is able to get his hands on, Corsan Bentado, and use to draw in more Sith reinforcements when they think they're bringing in prisoners. It really felt like a living, breathing era, as opposed to just tacked on, and that is something that, you know, Star Wars has trouble with from time to time. I'm not sure I felt that much in the previous 8 stories, but I think that was more just a matter of how there wasn't as much time to elaborate in those stories. Here, you know, it's much broader of a canvas for John Jackson Miller.
Yeah, I had the Lord of the Rings feel to it as well. I mean, it definitely had a Dark Ages, Middle Ages kind of feel to it. And the way the story worked, it made sense. It fit with what you were seeing. You know, the loss of the technology, the fact that they knew certain things for sure. You know, it's like okay, I have a lighter, and I could start my fire with a lighter. Doesn't mean that I don't know how to use flint and start a fire, but now that I no longer have a lighter, I'm going to have to follow my other skills. And that's kind of what you see the tribe do. You know, we see a lot of, in the first few books, we saw Dari fly off with all the Uvok, and then she hits that little island. Well, what you later find out is she did make it to Alanciar, and she was the herald. She was warning them all about the Sith. So they had 2,000 years to get ready for the Sith. They have been waiting for 2,000 years in a state of perpetual readiness for them to show up. And that, too, is another thing I liked about the way it was built up. I mean, the island of Alanciar was totally a perfect bastion for these guys. I mean, the way the hills all rolled down to everything, it was like they totally had overlapping fields of protection. They had people at the ready. I liked the way that played out. Again, in Chapter 3, you know, we learned that Adele, he's able to be on the scout ships because he's the one that came up with the process of the hydrogen balloons to get them there. And even in there was another reference kind of to Spiral. He talked about 3 years had passed since he'd gotten that far and then despair had fallen again. There was no method of controlling direction, exposing the balloons to all the violent whims of the ocean winds. The jet streams here in Kesh's southern hemisphere could provide a mighty assist, but they proved untamed. In the south, a change in the moods of the Celestial Spire and other volcanoes could send a flyer anywhere. Sometimes the Southlies carried riders up and up, presumably releasing them to perish among the mighty polar ice pack. And farther north, the equatorial route just sent riders to a watery death in the doldrums, or so they assumed, for none had ever returned from any of the flight tests. And I like how, you know, John Jackson Miller, he does a lot of that, like, or so they assumed, you know, and he leaves it open to the characters making an assumption that's probably going to turn out to be either right or wrong. And in this case, I would say, you know, these people could easily find themselves as part of the group that we see in Spiral because we don't have a clue how they got there. But he leaves it wide open. It's like, well, they disappeared and they could be anywhere or they could be dead. We're just assuming they're dead, but they could show up. You never know. It's a totally got that Marvel Comics feel. Like, is Johnny Storm really dead?
No, he's not. No, it reminds me of that thing we talked about, I guess, in a previous episode about this, that whole third-person limited thing, how characters were able to draw assumptions based on other people's motivations, and we got to hear those and know that it was just their assumption, but that keeps us from having the other person's assumptions revealed, or the other person's real motives revealed until the time comes where it really means it, or really, really needs it. So that idea of third-person unlimited versus third-person limited kind of view. What struck me looking at this, you mentioned the whole thing about how Adari winds up being the one who was the herald whose information about the Sith is what got them ready over the last couple thousand years. I never expected that. They started talking about when the herald came, and I expected there was some other event we hadn't heard of with some other character. It never struck me until further along in the story, oh, that must be Adari that they're talking about. Because I guess I didn't give enough credit to the writer, to John Jackson Miller, that we were going to see these stories build so that all the stories to some degree affected the conclusion, rather than it just being one set of stories somewhat affects the next set, somewhat affects the next set. We talked in the previous episode about how it's sort of like we have three different storylines before Pandemonium, like the first four, then the next two, and the next two. But it goes back to what I was saying early on, I think the first episode, where you've got a Star Wars feel from a story. A lot of times when you do like what Zahn did with the Thrawn trilogy, which is where you send off characters in different directions, and these different groups have their own little missions or their own little adventures, but eventually all those adventures tie together into one climactic moment or one climactic battle event so that it feels like it all had a purpose. And how in Lost Tribe of the Sith, they didn't have a lot of different locations to send the characters off to, so instead they're all trapped on the one world, but we have all these different factions, especially in the first four stories, that slowly bring themselves to a specific conclusion. Now I would say he's also done it in terms of time frames, where you've got the original four stories that in and of themselves lead up through the situation with Adari to help set up Pandemonium. Also, the second set of stories, books 5 and 6, those are needed to set up the Time of Rot, which are needed to set up books 7 and 8. But then 7 and 8 lead directly into the restoration and the beginning of creating the technology to get to Elancear that we need for this story as well. So in a sense, he winds up using eras very much like most Star Wars books use settings, and he uses factions like most Star Wars books use settings, to create a story that still feels like a bunch of different threads have now interwoven and given us this big finale, without it necessarily having to be something where we've got different planets involved or characters going off on ships somewhere. It's the same Star Wars formula, tweaked a little bit, to give us something that still works within the confines of just one planet, and in this case, just a couple of continents, where most of it's just on one continent. It feels Star Wars, despite being such an alien era and culture and level of technology.
Yeah, we actually have a book story here about sailing ships, and yet it feels like Star Wars. I mean, John, you rocked it again, my man. You know, in Chapter 7, we talk before the show started, we were having a little chat about, you know, ebooks and collected stories here and there. You know, we talked a little bit about that on the episode. But we were talking about Lando Calrissian's discovering of an AT-AT, one of the many's in what was the title of that one? I'm drawn.
Buyer's Market, aka yes. Unnecessary story.
Yes. Okay, that's my point. Unnecessary story. Now in Chapter 7, Adele's forces have found the mischance, the little sailing ship. It's in the wrong place at the right time for them. And meanwhile, Adele and his company made for the ship he'd seen, rowing hard against the cross current to reach it while the cover of night remained. The Kashyyyri sailors had indeed been unaware of the earlier battle. Surprise was absolute. They fought like wild animals nonetheless. It had taken the Sith until dawn to seize control of mischance, and even then, all but one of the defenders had fought to his death. Now, with the sun climbing to its autumnal noontime position in the north, the last mischancer had died in screaming agony under the torture of his questioners. Adele watched from the bow as Pepin emerged from the wheelhouse, removing her gloves. "What did you learn?" "Not much," Pepin said. "For a sea farmer's, they're made of pretty strong stuff." And to me, I was just like, oh, I would have loved to see that scene play out. Those type of moments happen in EU books all too often, where a great scene happens off the page. Apocalypse had a great little series of the Jedi being storming into their own Jedi temple that could have been the same thing. these kind of stories are the ones I would love to see in our little ebook exclusives, our insider short stories, our Timothy Zahn's doing a little, you know, thing like that. Relevant, something that captures the attention, not something that's just so obscure you really don't care. And that, I think, with the one with Lando, I think that's the case there. It was just so obscure that there was really nothing hanging on it. It's just a meh tale. In this situation, this is a story I would love to see how it would play out, to watch the Sith come on board the ship and take them out one at a time, one by one, till there was only one left. I don't know. I think that would be a really cool little short story.
This is true. This does leave a lot of openings to give us a chance to see other things. One of the things we could see, in theory, if he were to re-explore this particular story from another point of view, would be what happens on Keshta. Because we get to a point where we're following Adele, we're following him and Cora, her kind of as his prisoner, kind of as his guide, as she's sort of trying to show him other things about the way that they view the Sith and whatnot. So it's sort of to both of their advantage, and she thinks she's saving her friend's life, as they work their way through the landscape there on their way to the leadership. But at the same time that that's happening, the Sith have taken off in their captured little sailing ship and gone back to Keshta, everybody but Adele, pretty much. And they wind up getting there after Corson Bentado has already left with his ships, gotten shot down. So they're in the process where Corson thinks that now he has the ability to bring together the Sith and essentially take over Alanciar and use it to then take over Keshta from the other Sith. But while this is all happening, the Sith have gotten word about what's been happening and gotten word about the mythology, if you want to call it that, that has grown around them on Alanciar. And they're able to essentially recraft what they tailor what their prisoner sees when they get back to Keshta. So it looks like they can basically create this lie where, you know what? Yes, there were Sith who were the destructors, but that's not us. We are Sith too, but yeah, we were the protector version. The destructors were these other Sith, and we took them out. See, we are the protectors. Come back to help you. So you don't need to be worried about us. The enemy you've been preparing to fight, you don't need to fight. We took them out. We're friends. Come, let us eat together. Come, let us dine together, and let us bring our cultures closer to one, all in the process of essentially giving the Sith another chance to play their mind games like they did on the original Kashyyyri and take over this version of Kashyyyri culture as well. It's a nice sort of coming full circle to what we saw earlier, but it also opens up that realm of, well, what exactly happened there? What kind of conversations were had? It would have been interesting to see the Keshta version of these events as they were going on instead of just the events on Alanciar. But of course, if we had seen them during the course of this story, it would have given away the surprise of how things turn out at the end. They couldn't have just shown it in this story, but it might be interesting to see explored, maybe in flashbacks in Spiral, maybe in something else, maybe comic-wise, if there's another side story to be told at the time. But it's interesting that you don't have to see everything to get the good story. In fact, sometimes, in order to create any element of surprise, there are certain elements of a story that might be essential in the overall plotting that you can't see actively, otherwise it would give things away a little bit too early. I think that for the most part, this story leaves holes like that that you could fill in, but there's nothing I felt like had to be filled in, like we were missing a scene that was so crucial that without it, the story suffered from it. I think it actually benefited from certain scenes not being seen on screen, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to come back to the ending. One of those scenes for me was Ori and Jelf's return. Cora has a vision while she's on Alanciar, and she sees Ori, in fact, has a conversation with Ori. You learn that Ori and Jelf had three kids, and that they went into hiding. She's like, this is what hiding looks like, Ori replied. But the one thing I found interesting, and at the end, she goes, oh, you can follow a dream, Ori said, gazing back at her husband. The farmer looked up briefly and smiled back at the two of them before returning to his work. You can follow a dream, and you can build your whole world around one. She looked back at the Kashyyyri. You can live in a dream for a long time, but eventually, and then it goes back to Cora, finishing the sentence, and she goes, eventually the world will find you, she whispered and opened her eyes. The problem I had with that scene was it only worked for Cora. I was just kind of like, well, what would make you know, I kind of started thinking, like, okay, is this like how when Jason was doing his flow walking? I mean, is this like one of those kind of scenes? Did Cora actually talk to Ori, and did Ori actually talk to Cora in something? I wanted to know more about Ori and Jell's story, mainly because I really wanted to see where they were going. And the way that line ended, it was like, okay, did Ori and them get found by the rest? There was a whole story there that I wanted to know more of. It wasn't there, and it didn't destroy the book for me, but I definitely wanted to know more. Getting back to the end of the book, I felt when I first got to the end that I didn't find the end as good. It didn't have a good close to it for me. But then I stopped and I thought about, if I think of each of these books as a book and I compare Pandemonium's ending to any of those, I think the ending is just as strong, if not maybe even stronger than most of all the endings. It ends in a place where things are still wide enough open that there could be another story down the road. And that aspect, I think John did a really good job. You know, when Vanner Hilt showed up and he's wearing the bird costume and stuff, I was like, whoa, what's going on? It seemed like it wrapped up very fast. But again, it gets back to that, you know, all the other stories had that same kind of feel, and then another story would come along and there'd be more stuff added to it. So I'm at that spot in my mind where I'm thinking, okay, is John Jackson Miller got more story to tell here? I think it's very easy to say he could, based off of what we've seen in the other books. The styling of Pandemonium ends in the same way, where we could jump another 25, 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, and pick right back up. Jorgen, his character comes back, you know, like you had said, they crafted things to make him see things in a light that would help them. He comes back and becomes the new Herald, in a sense. He becomes the new Rock of Kesh. He's everything that Adari was at first. And that's where I said Cora kind of becomes everything Adari becomes later, the bitter side of her that forms a rebellion. It kind of sets her up in that light where she's going to get close to the Sith, if only to help her new rebellion. And so in a lot of ways, it's kind of like, here comes the circle again, and yet we're not quite to what we see come Lost Tribe of the Sith later in Fate of the Jedi. But again, there's about another, 3,000 years still to go. I mean, there's a lot of story potential here. And that's what I liked overall about this book. It gives you a really good look into multiple windows of the Lost Tribe of the Sith's history, how crucial points in their founding and forming help lead to what we see later. It's not the full story, but it's enough of the story to give you a good idea and give you a feeling to these individuals, where they're not just some written-in culture. You know, you see, in a sense, a deeper side of the Sith struggle. The Sith that we, you know, the old Sith, the original Sith, now we can look at in the light of they are the Stygnum Cauldron Sith. You know, they were the red Sith that were in the Stygnum Cauldron, that they were trapped there. And, you know, and the way that that worked out for the Sith species and how the Sith evolved into what we see today, a lot of that takes place in this book, and it's subtle. And I like the way that John Jackson Miller captured that, the struggle between the red Sith, the humans, how the slaves of the Tanapi end up, you know, coming into the Sith, kind of taking over the Sith, rising, and how we even watch the Kashyyyri slowly come into the Sith, and how they, too, start to form a niche in the society, and how they slowly, you know, we start to see them become equals, in a sense. We don't, by the end of this book, see them as the equals, or close to equals that we see later in the Fate of the Jedi and all that, but we see the progressive steps towards that. Vanner Hiltz especially, and even Adele, they were definitely some progressive, forward-thinking Sith. And that was another thing about the whole thing. It's always perplexing to me to read these Sith books. You know, when the EU first started out, there were very little Sith and dark side perspectives. It was something that we weren't going to touch. We didn't know where George was going to go. And now we're starting to see it. And what we're seeing, I find it so interesting. It captures my attention. And I find it very interesting and almost disturbing to find myself rooting for Sith that I know deep down in mine and George Lucas's conscience are the bad guys. And yet there are times where I find characters like Vanner and Adele that I really enjoy. You know, you had mentioned strong female characters, and Ilana was another character that I found was, you know, even though she got kind of suckered into the position she had, Corsin Bentado had even mentioned how as long as she was alive, Hiltz was going to live longer than all of them, and their chance was going to come and go. When he showed up and he slipped in and took over that lighthouse, the communication center, as I put it, it was like basically like if the Catholic Church was to be infiltrated at the Pope's Vatican, and the Pope was taken out, and they had a room where the Pope sent out messages to all the Catholics. In a sense, he has done that. He's taken over the Pope's position, and he's telling them all, hey, bring me food, bring all the prisoners here. And now, basically, the Roman Catholic Church has become the Sith base. And the way he went about that, I thought was really slick. And then the fact that he wanted to take down the rest of the Sith and set up a whole nother tribe, I was just like, whoa, where are we going? And that all worked out towards the end with Vanner's plan and how he kind of had a – he kind of, in a sense, foresaw something like that. Well, we'll just use them as scapegoats. This will all work to our advantage. And I like the way that at the end the dominoes all fit into place, even though I did feel like it kind of wrapped up and it was kind of like shoehorned in there. As a whole book, when I look at it as one more series of ebooks, if I look at this as continuing in the fashion that the ebooks did, I think it works. If there was going to be another one down the road or another series or another collection of stories, I think this could work. I think John Jackson Miller and Del Rey are onto something here. I would love to see this play further out.
Yeah, it does play very well. I think you've got a good point as to how the last story – it kind of ends very much like the other stories in the sense that it has a satisfying conclusion, but it's not some big, huge, explosive conclusion like you might see with a full-blown novel. It has essentially a novella or short story scale conclusion, and you need to read this book, if you're reading it for the first time, as a series of short stories. Interlinked short stories, yes, but as short stories. So you are not necessarily expecting it to wind up playing out the way that you would a novel. They're meant to be able to be read in individual sessions or as a whole. So, you know, it's an unusual Star Wars book, especially for those who are just now getting it in print, who never read any of the previous ones otherwise. I mean, in my case, I had read all the previous ones as ebooks as they came out, so they all felt like bite-sized little short stories. So when I got this book, I just read Pandemonium, and it felt like its own little, slightly bigger than bite-sized story. So I didn't get that kind of sense of, well, that was an odd way to end an entire book, but I do think that some who would be reading it now from scratch are going to get that feeling by the end. This book goes to show you, I think, and I think you made the comment there, that in the big picture, you don't have to have a bunch of Jedi. You don't have to have previously existing known characters. You don't have to be in a particularly well-known era or on a particularly well-known planet to create a captivating Star Wars story. I think that Lost Tribe of the Sith is a very accessible set of stories. You don't have to have read Fate of the Jedi to like the stories, and you don't have to have a whole lot of background on anything like, say, Cross Current or Golden Age of the Sith and Fall of the Sith Empire from Tales of the Jedi to enjoy it. I think it's a really good example of an accessible story. I would love to see how the numbers worked out for this, though the fact that it was first released with a lot of it in ebook form for free, I think probably is going to mean that we can't trust the book sales numbers on this like we would for something similar if it wasn't first released like that. Yeah. But it goes back to that sort of putting the lie to the idea that in order to make a story accessible, you have to use just film characters or cartoon characters just in familiar eras. Otherwise, it's not going to be something someone can just pick up and read without having to have all this big continuity knowledge. I think this is a perfect example of that, and yet, because it is an oddball among Star Wars publishing, even in terms of its size, shape, and format, when finally printed, I don't think that there's going to be many lessons taken from this that probably should be in that regard. I think there's still going to be far too much focused on the it must be accessible, and accessible only means one thing, not this other thing that also fits the definition.
Yeah, I have to agree. I think that there's been a lot of times with Dark Horse and Del Rey of late that they've kind of walked away with the wrong idea. I mean, here we have the premium trade paperback after they got done saying that, okay, that was a bad idea when it came to Gambit and Siege and Wild Space and all that. And yet we came back around. Now we're watching Dark Horse with the Star Wars ongoing series after they stepped away from ongoing series because that wasn't accessible enough. And you know, we see these circles, man. We're just going around in circles. I was one of those that when the ebooks came out, I was right there with you. I read them up till, I want to say it was Savior, or whichever one where Jelf came in. Sentinel. Sentinel was the last one I read. And at that point, I was worried about that whole, we get the mini excerpts here and there, and I would read it, and then the book would come out, and the excerpts were the first chapters of the story, and then I wouldn't want to get into the book. I was like, oh, I've read this already. I'm going to get something I haven't read. And I didn't want to do the same thing with this. It was like each book came so far separated that, like you said, they came in little chunks and they were little bite-sized. And yes, they worked like that, but I wanted the whole story. And so at Sentinel, I stopped reading. And by the time I got this, I mean, as I was rereading them, I'm like, okay, yeah, I remember this. I remember that. All right, yeah. But the way that they fit together as a solid book read worked a lot better. And that's where I get – when I got to the end of Pandemonium, I was just like, oh, that didn't work as a satisfying book conclusion. But then when I go back to that ebook style, it's like, okay, that worked as a series of stories. And if this continued, it would still work. You know, I mean, if we had another Lost Tribe Volume 2 that took another 8 books that John puts out down the road or another author or whatever, I could see that working. And I think in the aspect of the way they put it out there for free, I think it worked. Because, like, for me, I didn't read all of them. You did, I didn't. But it worked. I read enough of them to make me realize, okay, I'm interested in this. Oh, it's coming out in paperback. I want it in paperback. I'm going to stop reading now. So when I get it in paperback, I feel like I get even more for my money. Even though it was out there for free, that free was the bait. You know, I totally got hooked. They drew me in. For me, I realized I didn't need to continue with the free stuff. I was going to be buying the book anyway, and I would just read it all then. And I got enjoyment out of it. So there's multiple ways you could have gone about this. But I think in the end, that it was a win-win scenario. I think if Del Rey can look at that and like you say, don't focus on the sales numbers, you know? I mean, that gets back into that thing of, like, I would like to see when they publish the books that we get the paperback, the hardcover, and the audiobooks and the ebooks all at the same day. If they're so bent on numbers, then let's be honest, Del Rey. Let's put it all out there. Let's find out what's really selling good. You know, let's quit smoke and mirrors with the hardcovers. Oh, the hardcovers are our bestsellers. They're only a bestseller because you put them out there for a year and you got people like me that are so obsessed, we can't wait a year to find out what's going to happen because we know there's some little binghole out there that's putting up all the spoilers on a forum out there and it's going to ruin it for them. So you got to go out there and read it.
But isn't that the exact reason why, as a business, it makes perfect sense? They need to put the hardback out there first. I mean, print publishing, from a profitability standpoint, is getting its butt kicked right now by places like Amazon and all these discount sellers and such. Plus, you wind up seeing things happening with, like, the advent of ebooks and how ebooks, in many cases, if it's a new hardback, the ebook release is a little bit cheaper than that and so forth, as opposed to paperbacks, which tend to be about the same price. If you're going to maintain profitability as a publishing company, you've got to put stuff out there as hardback because you need to have that push of the extra profit coming in from that higher price tag or from a trade paperback like this one or whatever. It makes me kind of sit back and think that, you know, Del Rey should be thanking its lucky stars, as should, in many cases, Dark Horse. Because even if they were to put out something that did not get rave reviews, that was not a particularly extremely solid story, i.e. Dark Horse Dark Times, i.e. Del Rey Choices of One, even if they put out something like that, the fact that it has the name Star Wars on it means that there are going to be a massive number of people who will compulsively, as collectors, as fans, buy it. It's not about listening to the reviews. It's about just, it's Star Wars, I will buy it. I mean, think about the number of copies of, say, Republic Heroes that sold. And Republic Heroes' jumping mechanics and gameplay were subpar. I'll put it that way. I like the game. It's fun. But it's because it's Star Wars, and I feel like I'm playing through an episode or an extended set of episodes of the Clone Wars cartoon series. But they can put out subpar stuff. Reviewers can pan the stuff. Doesn't matter. People will still buy it. So if you're in a situation where you have a license that is that well-loved and is going to wind up selling that well, quality aside, then shoot, put out stuff as hardbacks. I'm surprised they don't do more stuff like Fate of the Jedi, where they launch more series with hardbacks to start with. Because, yes, there's going to be some who will say, no, I'm always waiting for paperback. Yes, there are some who would always buy it in hardback anyway. But for those who are in the middle, where they just want to read it and they don't care what format it's in, if you make it first available just in hardback, you're going to draw in a fairly large number of those people, and that little difference can make a big difference in terms of, you know, the financial bottom line. For us as consumers, it kind of stinks at times from a pocketbook standpoint, but I don't see how they could do it any other way. It's just one of those things. It's the great trap of Star Wars releases. It's the same thing how figure collectors have probably bought 8, 9, 10 versions of the same freaking character with the same character mold with a little bit of different paint and perhaps a different card, and ta-da, it's a new figure. No, it's not. Not really. Yeah. but
I'm having a hard time being even excited when I hear about new figures. You know, there's news coming out. Oh, this figure's coming out. It's like, you know what? I'm still looking for Jason, Jaina, Solo, and Kruk. Never came out where I'm at. Oh, but that wave has sailed. It's gone. You want to find a Kruk? $70 freaking. I couldn't find it when it was $17 or $9 or however much it's been jacked up to now. I mean, I don't know. I'm one of those that I think, you know, yeah, you can get more money on the hardcover, but I really think that maybe, just maybe, if they put them all out there, that they'd be shocked at what the real desire from the fans is. I don't know. I would like to see that.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting experiment, but I don't know. I just doubt it would ever happen. Then again, I never expected them to have a gaming company associated with Star Wars putting out a beta playtest of a game and charging what amounts with shipping to about $41 for it. Although, I'm a big Star Wars fan. I bought Edge of the Empire, but we'll talk about Fantasy Flight Games and some of their updates next episode, as we're also talking about that Celebration 6 material here. Then we are getting pretty close to the end of our episode here.
Yeah, we got about like 4 minutes, so you better get on that.
All right, well then, folks, that being said, remember, you can listen to the show, of course, airing on Middle Earth Network Radio, as well as streaming on the Star Wars Report website, starwarsreport.com. Our episodes are also available right on our Facebook page, facebook.com/SWBeyondFilms, which is also the same as our Twitter, SWBeyondFilms. Or you can just type in Star Wars Beyond the Films in the search bar on Facebook. No matter how you get here, be sure to like our page. It's one of the best ways to interact with us. We post comments, we post questions, we post discussions, and you can interact with us on a pretty regular basis there. And not only can you post comments while you listen to the show, you might be heard on the show. We do those feedback episodes about once a month when it's justified, and in those cases, we might use some of your feedback from Facebook. So if you have something to say about an episode, fire it off to us. You can also email us at SWBeyondFilms, the same as Facebook and Twitter, at StarWarsFanWorks.com. So, once again, this has been Nathan Butler,
Mark and Whistler,
saying thank you for listening, and may the Force be with you.
And don't quote us the odds. That's right, because Whistler doesn't know how to compute them at the moment. He's got a little chip broken from moving boxes. Corson Bentato. Yeah.